DOI Minister Michelle Hayward certainly seems in a hurry to get things done and bring about significant change to our lives, with government's record for speed being noteworthy primarily for its absence. You'd imagine the minister's drive and determination might be welcomed as a breath of fresh air. She certainly succeeded in dividing public opinion, but is she out of her depth or boldly taking on the controversial issues that others have feared to tackle? You certainly are not allowing the grass to grow under your feet in your new role as DOI. Well, it's perhaps not a new role now. I mean, how many months now is it getting on for?
Six and a half. Yeah.
So, you're certainly keen to get things done.
I am, because what's the point of being there if you're in a position where you can make decisions and drive things forward if you just sit around kicking things into meetings or committees or, consultants' fees for giving you a report that your officers probably knew what the report was going to say before they contributed to it. So I don't think that's part of the job, and I don't think that should be what anyone does when they're in this position.
And perhaps, I don't know, maybe you're beginning to learn why sometimes it does take government a long time to move things forward. Perhaps maybe a little less haste would deliver a bit more speed sometimes.
I think in the case of the 20s, it's been going on for so many years now. I mean, we go back to 2018 when this started coming up. So I don't think, 7 years later, I can be accused of too much haste in the process, to be fair.
But there are things perhaps, certainly you've already apologised and said maybe that things could have been handled a little differently, and as a result, maybe there would have been a little less controversy surrounding the whole issue.
Oh, and that's absolutely right. So our standard process for consulting on traffic regulation orders is we publish them for 2 weeks and send out an email address. That happened, and I think I knew about it after it was published, and there was no comms that went out around it. And I've apologised to Keyes and to Tim Ward and said we should have done better. But I've got officers who deal with traffic regulation orders on a daily basis, and they went through the process that they've always gone for, which is a 40-odd year old piece of legislation anyway that sets out how that happens. There's possibly some questions to ask about whether that process is still fit for purpose in the modern era. And it was quite obvious really early on that it just wasn't, that didn't fit with the scale of what we were trying to consult on. And so in some ways I've almost pressed pause and slowed it down. I know you've accused me of going too quickly here, but essentially, from that publication in March, we could have waited 2 weeks, got the emails in, and I could have signed the traffic orders or delegated powers. The officers could have signed the traffic orders off, and it would have all been and done and dusted. And what I've done is say, well, we'll slow that down. We'll take our time to go and talk to every community about the proposals for that community. And I think the speedy bit, which is a real kind of background bit, is that normally for traffic orders, you'd end up with pages of written description about, the road between this lamppost and that distance from a junction and things. And moving to the map-based system is the bit that's sort of sped things up, because otherwise we'd have never have had the capacity to talk about every residential area on the island in one go, because we'd have spent probably over a year just writing the traffic orders specifically for this project. So the moving to the maps was a kind of a step change in processing speed for the department, and probably absolutely right, because I think the maps are much easier to interpret than a written description of roads. But the actual consultation process that's now in play is my very much slowed down version of what a TRO consultation should look like. So everywhere is getting at least 6 weeks of consultation. We've got drop-in sessions running. I'm seeing all of the local authorities. We're providing an online portal that's a specific one that's used for traffic regulation orders, industry standard, to allow people to comment on individual roads. I'm trying to do as much as I can now to get as much consultation in as possible. And it wasn't what the department did was wrong, because it's the process that was set out in statute, but it just wasn't appropriate for the scale of this project.
And of course, the Tynwald has said that it wants to see 20 mile an hour speed limits in residential zones. So again, you know, you're the one that's name is all over this, and yet this is something that Tynwald pretty much agreed in principle to. They didn't necessarily agree to the detail, but the principle was in all home zones, all residential zones, there should be 20 mile an hour speed limits.
Yeah, and it was the last administration agreed to it in 2020. Anne Corlett brought it back in 2023, and this administration agreed to it as well. And I think the difficulty for the department then was they'd gone away in 2021. Then Minister Tim Baker came back with a presentation to members about, well, here we could do £3 million worth of road changes to make this happen. And that didn't get Treasury agreement. £3 million is a lot of money to spend on that. And having then got the 2023 resolution, the department sat there and thought, well, what can we do and where do we go with this? And obviously, whatever you do subsequently, signs are always going to be your first level of intervention. And there's really good evidence now from where cash-strapped councils across in the UK have put in signage-only schemes to try and bring speeds down and then move to do highways works as necessary afterwards if the speeds don't reduce. But part of that signage-only thing is about education. So, in some regards, if I want to look on the bright side, all of the media attention that's been placed around 20s, people are certainly aware of what we're expecting in residential streets is 20s. I think the other difficulty for the department was that Tynwald didn't define what it meant by residential streets. And so it was fine saying, residential streets and with a focus around schools. Well, I get where the schools are, that's fine. But do we talk about the routes to school and where children cross and where they move from, say, a housing estate across to a school as being part of that school zone as well? Because ultimately, that's what we're worried about, is the vulnerability of those pedestrians. And the department's had to come up with a set of criteria to try and define what we mean by residential roads, because it's not anything that appears in our manuals as such. We know where our towns and villages are, and we know where our settlements are, and we've got definitions around those. But actually, residential streets was a bit of a new one. So the criteria that we've got essentially try and work that out for us, in density of housing and looking for why there might be more risk to vulnerable road users around certain locations.
And I suppose this is then where the issue, when we do get into the detail, this is where some people have begun to raise, I think, reasonably legitimate concerns. You might have a densely populated area with a relatively wide road, which then leads into a relatively narrow country road, and effectively there'll be a end of speed limit sign as you get from what's possibly a reasonably safe looking wide road, heading onto a very narrow country road, and that inevitably people will raise things like that and say, well, that seems a bit strange, doesn't it? Because surely if the point of this is to reduce danger on the roads, that seems a bit counterintuitive.
I think we kind of have to look at it as starting somewhere. So just because there's this program, and this came from it was in the road safety strategy, it's been in living streets consultations, it's an idea. Speed reduction in residential areas has been around for a long time and been supported across a number of areas. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other challenges around road safety. And as you know, DOI works quite closely and as part of the Road Safety Partnership and with the Roads Policing Unit to look at all of those aspects. And that includes looking at our high-speed roads. And you mentioned the country lanes where we delimit the roads. We know that that they're responsible for a large proportion of our deaths on our roads are on high-speed roads. In fact, you can pretty much pick out the locations for where that's going to be because they're the risky spots. We know that young drivers, particularly those who are carrying lots of passengers in the car, are more at risk. We know that older drivers, particularly males, are at risk, and older male motorcyclists are also a risk group. But just because we're working on this doesn't mean that we've taken our eye off the ball on other things, but you know, we need to work through one bit at a time and unpick the problems as we go. So, you know, this is here now, and everyone who challenges me and says, oh, why are you focusing on this when there's this, this and this? There is always going to be a long to-do list of things to do, but the only way to start making any dent in that is to pick something and work away at that one. And once you've dealt with that one, then we'll move on to the next topic and the next thing to try and tackle.
I think it was Gary Cluett that mentioned or coined, I think coined a new phrase. Maybe it's one that I've just not come across before. The was it an ombi, I think he called it, the only in my backyard, yeah. Which basically describes what all DOI ministers and I presume transport ministers past have been aware of, that everyone wants speeds to be substantially reduced outside their homes, but no one wants them to be reduced. Well, I wouldn't say no one, but fewer people want to see the speeds reduced between their home and their workplace or wherever it is that they particularly want to drive. And I suppose that's often the problem for DOI. You are left in that position where you're having to make unpopular decisions to try and, in this case, make people safer, and it's often an uphill battle.
Yeah, I think that's true, and we're certainly in some of the feedback I've seen. Yeah, I've had direct emails from people saying, "Yes, I want this on my road. Yes, I want this. Yes, you know, I've young children, or I've lost a pet cat, or my wing mirror has been knocked off several times, and if the traffic was slower," and we know that was a large proportion of our kind of incoming post and emails before this was announced, was about people asking for speed reduction on their roads. And I think the people who live in an area are absolutely the experts in what it feels like to be there. Not to go out to work, but essentially a large proportion of their lives is going to be spent around their homes, and they are the ones who experience the sound of screeching brakes and traffic speeds going past. I know I had a comment from one of my constituents in Port St Mary who said they complained about, we put in speed monitoring strips and it was going to dunk, dunk, dunk. And they were complaining about the noise because the road had been so much quieter since the speeds had been reduced on it. And I think it was an unexpected bonus that they hadn't anticipated. And that, I think, is part of the problem with this, is that perhaps people don't understand the gains that come, because they're all quite soft gains. They reduced reduced microplastic pollution, which comes mainly from your tyres and brakes, reduced congestion, because actually if you keep the traffic flowing evenly at 20 miles an hour rather than doing the speed up and stop, speed up and stop, that reduces, we know that reduces pollutants. And so all of those things feel like they're just tiny little gains, and perhaps people don't see what it means for them necessarily. But if you are on a road where you've been blighted by speed of cars going past, people can see that kind of feeling for them of how much better it could be.
Because you I know when pressed on these points in Tynwald, you made the point that this was effectively about making the places that people live better places. It wasn't just about reducing speed, or it wasn't about reported accidents, because generally speaking there weren't that many reported accidents in the home zones. It was about that perhaps intangible idea, the very difficult to explain thing of a better place for people to live.
Yeah, and I think that's it. It's almost certainly true. It's trying to capture the we describe them as public health benefits, and it's almost like you don't know what you've got until that happens. So, I give an extreme example. You know, years ago when there was the landslide at Happy Valley, and there was a water leak under the road, and you know, it all washed away, and we had that road shut then for 3 months, and I live near that. When they rebuilt the road, our house had stopped vibrating every time a bus went past, because we didn't know that there were voids under the road and the whole thing was flexing until it had finally given away. And it was a weird sensation when the road reopened of suddenly realising that you couldn't feel the traffic anymore because of the construction of the infrastructure around you. And I think I'd never anticipated that was going to be the case. And I suspect when we start slowing traffic down on roads, those benefits that people hadn't really anticipated are likely to come through.
And possibly a little like, I mean, there were few positives during the various COVID lockdowns, but one of them was substantially less traffic on the roads, and people in the first few days when they were able to get out, because of course it was glorious sunshine for a lot of that period, it was just an amazing experience to be able to go and walk on what had been busy roads and hardly a car going past.
Yeah, and there is limited amount of data. So we do know that, yeah, I've got 5 years worth of data up to 2024. There were just over 500 accidents that the police were called out to in 30 mile an hour zones. And one in every five of those accidents was either was fatality or somebody was seriously injured. So that's a fairly good hit rate. Now, you can't directly compare the stats for 30 miles an hour to 20 miles an hour because we've got different lengths of road and you spend different amounts of time on them. But if we look at the call outs to 20 mile an hour collisions, there were much fewer. There were only 63 collisions anyway, and there was only a 1 in 10 chance of being a fatal or a serious injury as a consequence of that. So just by doing that, you know, the ambient speed for those roads, you are twice as likely to avoid that killed or seriously injured scenario. And that's borne out by data we see from elsewhere. And you're right, you know, generally Manx roads are quite safe. We're quite a small population. And so you have to look at those big studies that are done, you know, across number of towns or the meta-analysis of lots of data in order to see where those trends clearly come. The numbers here are so small and so variable year on year that you can't even promise that, you know, we put all the signs up this year and you'll see a drop off next year. I think Wales surprised themselves because their deaths on the roads dropped to levels that hadn't been seen since the 1970s when records first began, in the first full year after their speed reduction was in place. And I'd spoke to the Welsh Transport Minister. I met him at British Irish conference, and we were talking about the whole road speed things, and he said that wasn't in any of our predictions, because we thought, well, we're just dealing with 30 miles an hour roads, and so if people are at 30 and now going at 20, what we'll see is a slight drop off in number of accidents, but the severity drop they'd never predicted. And I, you know, somebody did come up to me at one of the road shows and she said to me, the thing to focus on here is that you won't know the child that you save as a consequence of these changes. My own son can tell me of a story where the bus stopped on Gansey. It was heavily raining. His friend got off the bus, walked in front of the bus to try and cross over because his house was just there, and stepped straight in the path of a van, got knocked over, got up, ran in the house, got his mum, came out. And the police weren't called down to the accident, even though there was somebody injured in it, but it was fine. You know, mum dealt with it and it all got logged. It doesn't appear on an accident stat. But he said he still vividly remembers, nearly 20 years on, how extreme that feeling was of watching your friend hurtle through the air and things, and how much it traumatised him. And now that's something we don't measure. When you start talking about bald stats about, you know, who was killed and who was seriously injured, that doesn't appear anywhere in those stats, that impact on people. And I think it is about trying to understand that wider impact on people's lives.
I mean, you've mentioned there the road shows. I mean, you've been doing a lot of talking over the course of the last few weeks. What sorts of... I mean, presumably you will have people who are very supportive talking to you, but you'll also have quite a lot of hostility as well. How has it panned out?
I think at the road shows, on balance, the people who are coming up to do the one-to-ones with the minister beforehand, maybe a third of all those people wanted to discuss 20 miles an hour, and they were roughly split half and half. Those who are broadly supportive of it usually come up with quite a short message of, I agree with what you're doing, keep going, you know, and you want to talk to them for a bit longer, to be fair. Those who are against it will cite that this is an overreach. I've had allegations that we don't have the legal powers to do this, that we've broken the act in doing it. There was some confusion early on about whether the chief constable had been consulted on. I met with him directly and we talked about it, but he'd been consulted on via the Road Safety Partnership anyway, which is the normal route for these things to occur. And I agree with him to a large extent. This won't affect the killed and seriously injured numbers, which is what his focus is, and that's what he's charged with reducing. So, you know, we can start talking there about what do we do with young drivers and what do we do with speed on roads generally. and it's not his focus. So I agree with that. And then it all gets misquoted as, well, it's illegal because you haven't. Of course, it's legal, and you know, we have the powers to do this. I've had people going as far as doomsday scenarios, that if you bring this about, then what will happen is there will be civil unrest and there'll be riots. And I get the argument that says government shouldn't overreach, but actually, for every residential street that's gone in the last 25 years, there's been a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit on it. And so really what we're talking about is a mopping up exercise for all those residential streets that existed for the 70 or 80 years before that, where that wasn't what normal procedure was. And I think there is a shift in how we view our built environment, because actually the towns and the villages that we have should be about the people who live in them more than they are about speeding cars through them. And certainly, I think that's probably, when you go back and look at the Tynwald debates, that's what guided their thinking at the time, is that shift to the pedestrians and the residents in our area being the ones that should be given the greatest consideration.
It's often, well, what you're proposing, and well, I say you're proposing, I mean, it was Tynwald that proposed, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you're implementing. But what's being done here is often compared with the situation in Wales, where a similar thing was done. Is it the same or is it different, would you say?
No, Wales took a really different... So Wales did do the mapping thing that I talked about earlier, of being able to say, right, on maps we'll do this. But actually Wales took the absolute blanket approach of saying, well, every sign that says 30 on it, we will change to a 20. And we'll apply that across the whole country simultaneously. So that was their approach. And what they didn't do was look at the roads, look at the features of the road, look at whether those roads were serving a school or a community, and how that might work. So having done that, literally a blanket change, they then, in the face of the backlash, have given £5 million back to local authorities and said to local authorities, well, work out what your communities actually want. And it depends on where you go. Somebody sent me very kindly a snippet of Wrexham are changing 52 roads across their area. I know that in Cardiff they were asked to review 290-odd roads, 60 of which turned out not to be 20s or not in Cardiff. But apart from those, once they sifted through everything else, they're changing 4 roads back to being 30s. And because they were wider pavements and the risk factors were considered lower and there were good crossings available for pedestrians, so there were a variety, but every road was judged on its merits. And the flip to what we've done is we've started out with the, well, let's assess. And so the maps that we produced, which are the proposals, are based on a set of criteria where we've assessed what would be the reasons for this road being 20 and what would be the reasons for it being 30. And in some cases, it's really clear cut. That it'll go to 20 or it'll stay at 30. And then other cases are a bit more nuanced, and you've got some factors that say, well, perhaps it should be 30, and some that say... And so officers at the time used their judgment and their experience and whatever data they had available about the speeds on that road to look and say, well, OK, on balance, we think we're going to recommend this one for 20 or 30, and it appears on the maps or it doesn't. And what the consultation is now doing is saying to people, well, does this feel right to you? Does it pass that scratch test of, you know, does it? Sometimes you look at things and you think instinctively, yeah, I get where that's coming from. And there are lots of bits of, if you pick Douglas, for example, you know, I challenge anyone to drive around Derby Square at more than 20 miles an hour. They certainly can't do 30 around it. So in practical terms, it will make very little difference there. But it is about setting that concept and that understanding from drivers that I'm in a residential area and therefore my speed is going to drop back.
The issue with the poles being put up, I mean, that's been reasonably well explained. But just in case any listeners haven't heard the explanation, yeah. Basically, this was a... Well, they're already up, so to take them down again would
oh yeah, not... it would be daft to take them back down again. So as you'll know, the DOI has a number of projects underway at any given time, and those projects are planned in usually months in advance. You're working ahead, and so work on the traffic orders would have started last year. And as the part of that work, when you're looking at what we've got upcoming, you look at what budgets are available and you think, well, okay, I know I'm going to need these materials, so I'll need to get the materials in ahead of starting anything. I'll need to program in the work, so we'll need contractors in and we need to give them rough dates. Well, if we're going to publish the traffic order here, then we can expect that we'll be signing that off and it'll be going live. And so that process was kind of underway. The traffic orders get published in March. I was going to say press pause, but I didn't. I said, right, you know, the consultation needs to change and stuff like that. So we pivoted away from the statutory consultation to do something that was much more engaged and much more involved and was going to take us a long period of time. And nobody really pressed pause on installing poles because it was just part of the ongoing work stream, of which the department has that many in train. So it's a miscommunication in a way. It's unfortunate. I apologise to people for the distress that it's caused them seeing poles go up. Some of the poles possibly aren't in the right place because, you know, once we've done consultation and we've taken those views on board, we may decide we need to move them. In fact, I've got some areas where the poles are too far in and they probably need stretching out because there'll be more 20 mile an hour zones than we'd proposed so far. And that's been the really valuable bit about the consultation, is getting that local knowledge and understanding about how people move around their particular area. The polls thing hasn't helped, definitely hasn't helped, has put the pressure on and has allowed people to claim that the DOI are not listening and had no intention of listening and to dismiss the consultation. But the consultation has been really, really, really valuable, and the conversations you've had with people, even people who've come into the drop-in sessions and they say, I don't want this. And you're like, okay, but I have 127 miles of roads that are already 20 mile an hour, home zones and the like. It's the stretch in Ballasalla, 127 miles. If you say, no, I don't want 20 miles an hour, is the implication then I should take all of those out? To which the answer is invariably, oh no, you can leave those. Anything you've got already, you can keep. Okay. And then we talk about schools and everyone says yes around schools. But we have schools that are still not protected by 20 mile an hour zones. So not only can I keep the schools I've got inside 20 miles an hour, but I can protect the extra schools that aren't protected. And then it becomes a question of those routes to school. And if you know you've got significant numbers of children crossing at, say, Hillbury to get across to schools up in Onchan, do you consider whether their route should be protected by 20 miles an hour, or is there a need for an additional crossing and things like that? And crossings are remarkably expensive compared to signage. But, you know, how do we make that work? And generally, by the time I've started out with somebody who said, no, I don't want this, I've got to, but you can have residential streets. You can have more residential streets if the speed's not high around them anyway. You can have schools. You can have the schools that aren't protected. And I think we're somewhere along the way to, and that's most of what we've proposed, to be fair. There are very few roads that I look at and I think, well, could that count as a distributor road or not? I can give you an example. Victoria Road at the top end there, as you come away from the Glencrutchery Road junction, that doesn't feel like it's got lots of pedestrians around it and that it's got lots of risk factors associated with it. But we know traffic volumes are really up there because of the new Tesco store being in place, seen significant increases in traffic. And that's a bit I'm not sure about. So we've asked for some, you know, I've been talking to the engineers about the data that they have for that roads and what's the justification for that top end. And that's the sort of thing that's coming through on the consultation. People say, well, generally, yes, actually, I'm fine with all of this. But it's just those other bits. And the department genuinely is listening. You know, there is a whole programme now of work to take on board all of those comments from the consultations and all of those roads that are challenged to work through and say, well, when we look at that data again, was the right call made in the first place? What was the justification? Why did the officer think this way or that way? And actually, is there a good case for expanding or contracting accordingly?
And going back again, because this is a Tynwald decision, was there much opposition in Tynwald to this?
So both the initial votes, the 2020 and the 2023 vote, were both unanimous. So absolutely no opposition at all at that time. The implementation plan, there was some opposition. I think, did it go through, it was 19 votes or something in the Keys to accept it. And it was, you know, there were some comments made about, well, it's strange to come back with an implementation plan. That's quite operational level of detail that normally you wouldn't see. And Mrs. Corlett amended it to put some of the actions from the implementation plan on the face of the motion and say, well, Tynwald agrees with these actions and approves you to get on with these. I guess from my perspective, because it is a project that has been around for a very long time, I welcome the fact that I've taken an implementation plan with timings into Tynwald. And I'm using that now to hold the officers to, come on, we're on a delivery schedule here, let's move on and do this. Because I think the time to have those conversations is now. And yeah, we'll finally end up in the south somewhere in November or whatever, talking about what's going to happen around Castletown and Colby and Port Erin. And that allows then the department to have a clear plan about what it's got to do in the way of installation and moving forwards. And it is about moving things along rather than it being kicked into the long grass again. I think it was a possible amendment from Miss Edge that was going to make us come back with a report in October, and you think, oh, we've done so much work up to this point, you know, but actually you were always going to have to do a public consultation, and you were always going to have to do something much better than a 2-week response to a statutory traffic order notice. So actually this is that consultation, and whether the poles and the signs go in for each area, you know, immediately, or whether they go in at some point in the future, because it will have to be scheduled into to work that the department's doing. That's still, you know, sort of programming that's ongoing. And once we know exactly what the support is from a community for the different roads, then that's what we'll move forward with. But the public consultation phase was always going to have to happen. And just because the law says I can go and sign off traffic orders doesn't mean that it was a good idea to do it without doing that consultation.
And of course, what is unusual, and I guess most people listening to this programme maybe don't really understand how the process of making decisions works. You actually have the power under various Road Traffic and Highways Acts. You have the power already to do this. You could implement this yourself without recourse to Tynwald. What's unusual is to get, as you've described, two unanimous votes in Tynwald saying, actually, Minister, we want you to do this. Mm. So it's not like the often when I've been following this situation in the media, on social media, it appears as though it's just that hard-headed minister who's determinedly pressing on with this. This is something that really does have full support from Tynwald members.
It genuinely does, and I think there's been a number of challenges where people say, well, tell me the data then, tell me for, you know, this 30 mile an hour road, tell me how many people were killed or how many people were seriously injured, and you know, this focus on numbers and things. And I'm not sure that's entirely helpful, because I'm not sure what an acceptable level of serious injuries or fatalities is on a road. You know, at what point do you think we should trigger acting? And arguably the road safety partnership sets a kind of goal of having that at zero, so which is, you know, pretty much unachievable, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't aspire to design your roads like that. So there's been this push for, well, what's the data that underpins this, show me the data and show me. And actually the data doesn't need to underpin it, because as you said, Tynwald voted for it for whatever reasons, and you know different members of Tynwald will have had different reasons for supporting it. But if you go back and look at those debates, there was clear understanding about what members were trying to achieve and what they wanted to achieve with this. I suspect some of them may not have understood the process that then triggered, or the legal vias under which that could happen, or the implications of trying to work through that. But, you know, obviously they do now. And you're right, I have the power as minister. Actually, I delegate the powers to sign off traffic regulation orders down to officers, because, you know, the half a dozen or so a week that need to be done, that's fine. It's a decision that can be handled at officer level.
Most cases you're talking about an additional reserved parking space outside someone's home,
exactly.
Or a modest tweaks to different things. Yeah,
yeah, and given the magnitude of what's proposed at the moment, fairly early on in the process, I took away the delegation for officers to be able to sign this one off, so it will come across my desk and I will sign off once we're happy. So post consultation, when we've reevaluated the roads, rechecked them, we'll republish the maps, there will be the 2-week period where we can get further comments, and then after that it'll be me signing the, 'cause there's part of me that feels I have to take political responsibility for this. The department's been instructed to do it by Tim Ward. These are the mechanisms and the legal processes that we need to go through to get to that point. But I felt it was important to take accountability for it. And so I've asked officers not to sign them and told them that to land up on my desk before they get signed.
Why did the former minister, the late, sadly recently passed, Tim Baker, why did he come forward with this £3 million of roadworks required to effectively implement the 20-mile-an-hour speed limits?
I think if you step back in time to when the 20 limits are just starting to come through in various towns and cities across the UK at that point, the data would suggest that unless you change the road to force traffic to slow down, it doesn't necessarily. And there was very limited understanding of what signage-only schemes could do and the impact that they might have. In fact, since then, we've got more knowledge. So I think he worked with the best advice at the time. And we went out for an engineering firm, came in, looked at various road options for us and generated this 140 locations where we could. And I saw some of those when I was in Portsmouth Commissioners, and it involved traffic tables and islands and all sorts of engineering fixes that I just thought were wholly inappropriate for Portsmouth, and on the commissioners at the time pushed back against that. Some of those locations, they're probably justified. There probably are things that we need to do and do, but we'll work through doing those on our minor capital works budget over a period of time. And we've always said with the signage, we'll put the signage in, we'll monitor road speeds and the effect, and we'll review it. And actually, if we need to make changes, and some of those changes can be quite subtle. The planters up at St Mark's, which got roundly criticised when they went in, been proven to cut average speeds through there by around 8 or 9 miles an hour. And that's the average speed, so a lot lower than it was. And we haven't had serious accidents up there in the last 6 years. So they're remarkably effective for some wooden planters that I believe we've planted up recently, although somebody might have hit one at the weekend, I was being told. But, at least they're relatively easy to replace and relatively cheap. And we've seen things like at Port Sodrick, where you've got the give way bits and you create that priority access. That slowed speeds through Port Sodrick to a large extent as well. So there are bits of really subtle road engineering that we can do that don't involve speed. I'm not a fan of speed cushions and humps and tables and all of those things, because traffic tends to slow down as it gets to it and speed up again. So you actually almost increase traffic noise as you do it. So I think we can be quite clever about how we change our roads to kind of force that understanding from the driver that this road needs to be driven at a slower speed, so they'll naturally drop down, they create that perception that the road is a little bit narrower than they were expecting, whatever, and we can bring about that change. But the ultimate aim here is to slow down traffic, to make life better for people. It's not about fines, and it's not about speed cameras, and it's not about policemen standing there, because a policeman standing there in a yellow vest is only effective for the time the policeman stood there in the yellow vest. Actually, it's about making the roads so that they are slower speeds, and that will take us some engineering stuff, which will probably be a programme that rolls on for quite a few years. Yeah, I should think.
I'm sure we could fill the whole of this programme talking about 20-mile-an-hour speed limits. You've probably covered it more than you would ever wish to ever have to talk about it ever again. There are a few other things that you've been involved with since you've become minister, one of which was the Local Government Amendment Bill. Now, I should obviously declare an interest here as a clerk to a local authority, but it's fair to say that the passage of the bill through Keys and now LegCo hasn't been as straightforward perhaps as you might have imagined.
That's been another one of those bits of legislation that's been around for a long time. In fact, I remember being consulted about it in 2017, 2018-ish time as a commissioner. So the fact that it's still not managed to make its way through Keys until recently, I think is, just a testament to how much work has gone on it. But the department had other priorities and was caught up in other things, and we didn't have drafting resource to complete the changes that we needed. So you know, it's made its way through Keys now. As you've said, it's up to Legislative Council, and they've got their evidence session scheduled for the autumn. So looking forward to attending that and contributing what we can. But some of the changes that are in there have been proposed for so long, they shouldn't be a surprise to anyone in a local authority. And if there are newer members of local authorities who don't quite understand it and they want to have a quick briefing, you know, if they get in touch with me, then I'm happy to explain where we're up to, aren't I?
There was, though, the introduction by a member of your department, a new clause in the House of Keys. Now, in an answer in I think it was Tynwald, maybe it was in the Keys, to Chris Thomas, the Chief Minister said that there was a collective responsibility view taken by council ministers in relation to that amendment. Mm-hmm. You, as minister, voted for the amendment. Council's view was to vote against the amendment. Is that a correct interpretation of the facts? Or?
So, well, we'll start out because Mr. Hooper's amendment was drafted up before he became a member of the department.
Right.
So he'd already worked on that and had that drafted up. He had actually spoken to the department before I joined the department and before I invited him to join the department about it. So that comes through and we kind of, it was that transition period to coming into the department. There was some councillor ministers' discussions that perhaps weren't communicated to me as clearly, and yeah, some confusion on the day. And I did explain the situation to the Chief Minister about why I'd voted the way I did. I think, even like, looking back at it now, the new clause 2, which is the one that caused that situation, probably wasn't as important as news clause 1, which is what councillor ministers had clearly agreed that we were supporting and the department was supporting. So it is what it is.
So councillor did support new clause 1.
It was
the new clause 2.
It was new clause 2.
And of course that new clause 2 didn't get support in the House of Keys.
No, it didn't get support in the House of Keys. And then we spoke to local authorities about their understanding of that new clause too. And they're not broadly happy with it either. But actually, it's fine. We're not putting it forward for LegCo and asking them to reconsider it. It'll fall by the wayside now.
What is the point of new clause 1? Why is this introduced? Just, I mean, I know, you know, but I guess most people listening to this programme won't know.
So local authorities straddle a whole load of services that they provide on which our communities depend. Some of those are set out in statute, particularly things like the Public Health Act, which covers collecting rubbish, household rubbish and things. Others which aren't set out in statute, however, we as communities all rely on. So no local authority is obliged to provide an amenity site, for example. However, it would be impossible to see how our towns and villages would work if there wasn't an amenity site for people to be able to deal with their household waste sensibly. Not the kitchen waste, but, you know, the other things that they need to recycle or to dispose of. And so what new clause 1 really recognises is that without going through and changing lots of things to make them statutory functions, the department can propose to Tynwald that certain things ought to be functions that should be delivered by local authorities, and to impose a duty on those local authorities to either deliver them or to pay for their delivery. So we know that local authorities charge rates that cover the provision of amenity sites and contributions towards swimming pools and libraries and other things. We don't have the power to compel that to happen. And if local authorities started pulling out of those things, because sometimes they're difficult and hard facilities to manage, and they can be expensive to manage, and everyone has an eye on what we're charging our ratepayers. And that's right, you'd be really conscious of what your rates are. But actually, you know, an easy way of cutting your costs would be to say, well, I'll just stop doing these things. And yet our communities depend on those things. So new clause 1 is really there as a catch-all for the department to be able to say, hang about, in the grand scheme of things, we expect you to be delivering this, and that's what we're relying on you to do.
And I know we've, in the discussion prior to this, we were talking about, you were saying, well, the statistics don't really matter. It's all about introducing these things. I will, though, ask what circumstances have occurred that the department feels the need to have this new clause to address?
So I can give you a couple of examples. So I've just sat on the minor capital works committee discussion, and there was a call for a pedestrian crossing to be installed in one of the northern parishes. And in order for the pedestrian crossing to be safe on the road that it was on, we needed to have improved street lighting around there. Now, the department is not the street lighting authority. That is the province of the local authority. The local authority refused to pay for two streetlights to go in. And so as a result, the crossing has not been provided for that community. Now, we have no powers to compel them to provide those streetlights, but the highways engineering assessment was it would be unsafe to put a crossing there without lighting either side of that stretch of road. So this is one of those examples where it falls through the cracks, that the local authority refusing to fund streetlights means we don't get, and that to me just seems insane, that you can't provide a crossing at a point where we know we have good data that the crossing would be useful. So there's the well-known situation up at Bride, and currently the department is spending money subsidising contributions into the Northern Civic Amenity site to keep it open, because we recognise how valuable that site is for the population that lives within close proximity, and how needed it is for the residents. But if local authorities decide to walk away from that, and all civic amenity sites have their challenges, they're all difficult facilities to run, where does it leave us? You know, we talked at the time about it, you know, possible increases in fly tipping and all sorts of things. We'd see all sorts of inappropriate waste going into the household bins, and you know, the gate charges that would go up. It's just not a situation that we can countenance. So this gives us the powers to step in if we need to, and to keep providing those services.
Of course, the situation with the northern civic amenity site is that there isn't a Northern Civic Amenity site board created. There are boards for the south, east and west, but there isn't one for the north.
Mm-hmm.
Tynwald, though, could introduce or support an order to create a board.
We could come through and do that. That's not the feeling that we're getting from the Northern authorities at the moment, that they want to go down that route. So we've got another 6 months or so to run on the current setup, and we'll need to work out what's going to happen after that. My intention is that not only should there be a Northern amenity site, but that we need to reset how we're doing our waste hierarchy. So we talk about reduce, reuse and recycle, and the focus has always been on the recycle element, and actually I want the focus to shift to the reuse element, because that's where we know the big environmental gains come. It's not about recycling things, it's about finding repurposing them and using them before you get to that recycling step. We don't need to reduce stuff back down to its base level and rebuild it into something if we can carry on using it. So I'm working on the waste strategy that we're due to deliver in the autumn, and I can expect a kind of refocusing that pushes it back. And then I want to see the amenity sites kind of flexing towards that model as well. I think one of the things that people really prize about amenity sites is that those reuse facilities. We've seen them under pressure, and there has to be some reasonable governance about it. But actually, from an environmental perspective, that is clearly where we need to move to, and that's what we'll be supporting in the future.
Well, we're almost at the end of the programme, not quite, but you're a third of the way through your current term as DOI Minister. You have two-thirds of your term to go. What excitement can we expect in the next year, in the run-up to the election, from the DOI Minister?
It's like Michelle's list of difficult things. I've been sat on the DOI's desk for a while. So I'm due to come back to Tynwald to report on bus passenger facilities for Douglas. We all know about the challenges around Lord Street and whether it provides for our bus passengers as well as it should. And there is an outstanding Tynwald motion from Joni Farragher around this, so we're looking at options on that. I've dusted out the horse trams business case, and we're having a look at that. I'm very cognizant of the fact it's the 150th anniversary next year, and I went down for a visit last week or the week before It's all a bit blurry. Went down for a visit and had a look around and looked at the potential for what we do around that space as well. So there's that to come. What else is floating around on the horizon? The Liverpool ferry terminal costs may be decided by then. There's a lot of contractual discussions and legal wranglings going on over that as well. So that's likely that that'll appear on the horizon at some point. So there's a lot of hard work still to do in the time and a lot of difficult things to try and tackle.
Well, you're smiling, so you must be still enjoying the role.
I can't work out if I'm truly mad or what, some sort of masochist. It's one of the most rewarding and one of the most challenging things I've ever done. I am enjoying the role, but it's because I think I'm a solutions focused person, and I know that might wind some people up because I want to get on and find solutions and move things forward. But that is that's my MO. That's what makes me tick, is trying to deal with these things. And in some ways there's that challenge. Somebody says, well, it's a bit tough. We've never managed to quite finish this. And I'm working on finishing some stuff off and getting it off the to-do list, because otherwise it just sits there and these things drag on for years and years and years and nobody ever comes to a resolution. And I think that holds us back then on all sorts of other things that we could be doing.
That was DOI Minister and MHK for Russian, Michelle Hayward. So what do you think? Is the minister being unfairly picked upon for doing what Tynwald twice unanimously voted for? And are local authorities protesting too much about legislative changes being driven through by DOI, or is the minister polarising local government politics? I'm Phil Gorn. Gorimayos ungeistachrom. Thanks for listening.